Part 3. Some 5 years after Wolff, in answer to a plea made here term after term that we overturn its doctrine on applicability of the Weeks exclusionary rule, this court indicated that such should not be done until the states had adequate opportunity to adopt or reject the Weeks rule. There again it was said, never until June of 1949 did this court hold the basic search and seizure prohibition in any way applicable to the states under the 14th Amendment. And only last term, after again carefully reexamining the Wolff Doctrine in Elkins versus United States, the court pointed out that controlling legal principles as to search and seizure and the problem of admissibility seemed clear until the announcement in Wolff that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment does not itself require state courts to adopt the exclusionary rule of the Weeks case. At the same time, the court pointed out the underlying constitutional doctrine which Wolff established, that the federal constitution prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures by state officers, had undermined the foundation upon which the admissibility of state-seized evidence in a federal trial originally rested. The court concluded that it was therefore obliged to hold, although it chose the narrower ground on which to do so, that all evidence obtained by an unconstitutional search and seizure was inadmissible in a federal court, regardless of its source. Today, we once again examine Wolff's constitutional documentation of the right to privacy free from unreasonable state intrusion, and after its dozen years on our books, are led by it to close the only courtroom door remaining open to evidence secured by official lawlessness in flagrant abuse of that basic right, reserved to all persons as a specific guarantee against that very same unlawful conduct. We hold that all evidence obtained by searches and seizures in violation of the Constitution is, by that same authority, inadmissible in a state court. Part 4. Since the Fourth Amendment's right of privacy has been declared enforceable against the states through the Due Process Clause of the 14th, it is enforceable against them by the same sanction of exclusion as is used against the federal government. Were it otherwise, then just as without the Weeks rule, the assurance against unreasonable federal searches and seizures would be a form of words, valueless and undeserving of mention in a perpetual charter of inestimable human liberties, so too, without that rule, the freedom from state invasions of privacy would be so ephemeral and so neatly severed from its conceptual nexus with the freedom from all brutish means of coercing evidence, as not to merit this court's high regard as a freedom implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. At the time that the court held in Wolff that the amendment was applicable to the states through the Due Process Clause, the cases of this court, as we have seen, had steadfastly held that as to federal officers, the Fourth Amendment included the exclusion of the evidence seized in violation of its provisions. Even Wolff stoutly adhered to that proposition. The right to privacy, when conceded operatively enforceable against the states, was not susceptible of destruction by avulsion of the sanction upon which its protection and enjoyment had always been deemed dependent under the Boyd, Weeks, and Silverthorne cases. Therefore, in extending the substantive protections of due process to all constitutionally unreasonable searches, state or federal, it was logically and constitutionally necessary that the exclusion doctrine, an essential part of the right to privacy, be also insisted upon as an essential ingredient of the right newly recognized by the Wolff case. In short, the admission of the new constitutional right by Wolff could not consistently tolerate denial of its most important constitutional privilege, namely, the exclusion of the evidence which an accused had been forced to give by reason of the unlawful seizure. To hold otherwise is to grant the right, but in reality to withhold its privilege and enjoyment. Only last year, the court itself recognized that the purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter, to compel respect for the constitutional guarantee in the only effectively available way, by removing the incentive to disregard it. Indeed, we are aware of no restraint similar to that rejected today, conditioning the enforcement of any other basic constitutional right. The right to privacy, no less important than any other right, carefully and particularly reserved to the people, would stand in marked contrast to all other rights declared as basic to a free society. This court has not hesitated to enforce as strictly against the states as it does against the federal government the rights of free speech and of a free press, the right to notice and to a fair public trial, including as it does the right not to be convicted by the use of a coerced confession, however logically relevant it be, and without regard to its reliability. And nothing could be more certain than that when a coerced confession is involved, the relevant rules of evidence are overridden without regard to the incidence of such conduct by the police, slight or frequent. Why should not the same rule apply to what is tantamount to coerced testimony by way of unconstitutional seizure of goods, papers, effects, documents, etc.? We find that as to the federal government, the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, and as to the states, the freedom from unconscionable invasions of privacy and the freedom from convictions based upon coerced confessions do enjoy an intimate relation in their perpetuation of the principles of humanity and civil liberty secured only after years of struggle. They express supplementing phases of the same constitutional purpose to maintain inviolate large areas of personal privacy. The philosophy of each amendment and of each freedom is complementary to, although not dependent upon, that of the other in its sphere of influence. The very least that together they assure in either sphere is that no man is to be convicted on unconstitutional evidence. Part 5. Moreover, our holding that the exclusionary rule is an essential part of the Fourth and Fourteenth Amendments is not only the logical dictate of prior cases, but it also makes very good sense. There is no war between the Constitution and common sense. Presently, a federal prosecutor may make no use of evidence illegally seized, but a state's attorney across the street may, although he supposedly is operating under the enforceable prohibitions of the same amendment. Thus, the state, by admitting evidence unlawfully seized, serves to encourage disobedience to the federal Constitution, which it is bound to uphold. Moreover, as was said in Elkins, the very essence of a healthy federalism depends upon the avoidance of needless conflict between state and federal courts. Such a conflict, hereafter needless, arose this very term in Wilson v. Schnettler, 1961, in which, in spite of the promise made by Ray, we gave full recognition to our practice in this regard by refusing to restrain a federal officer from testifying in a state court as to evidence unconstitutionally seized by him in the performance of his duties. Yet the double standard recognized until today hardly put such a thesis into practice. In non-exclusionary states, federal officers, being human, were by it invited to and did, as our cases indicate, step across the street to the state's attorney with their unconstitutionally seized evidence. Prosecution on the basis of that evidence was then had in a state court in utter disregard of the enforceable Fourth Amendment. If the fruits of an unconstitutional search had been inadmissible in both state and federal courts, this inducement to invasion would have been sooner eliminated. There would be no need to reconcile such cases as Ray and Schnettler, each pointing up the hazardous uncertainties of our heretofore ambivalent approach. Federal-state cooperation in the solution of crime under constitutional standards will be promoted, if only by recognition of their now mutual obligation to respect the same fundamental criteria in their approaches. However much in a particular case insistence upon such rules may appear as a technicality that inures to the benefit of a guilty person, the history of the criminal law proves that tolerance of shortcut methods in law enforcement impairs its enduring effectiveness. Denying shortcuts to only one of two cooperating law enforcement agencies tends naturally to breed legitimate suspicion of working arrangements whose results are equally tainted. There are those who say, as did Justice, then Judge, Cardozo, that under our constitutional exclusionary doctrine, the criminal is to go free because the constable has blundered. In some cases, this will undoubtedly be the result. But as was said in Elkins, there is another consideration, the imperative of judicial integrity. The criminal goes free if he must, but it is the law that sets him free. Nothing can destroy a government more quickly than its failure to observe its own laws, or worse, its disregard of the charter of its own existence. As Mr. Justice Brandeis dissenting said in Olmstead v. United States, 1928, our government is the potent, omnipresent teacher. For good or for ill, it teaches the whole people by its example. If the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy. Nor can it be lightly assumed that, as a practical matter, adoption of the exclusionary rule fetters law enforcement. Only last year, this court expressly considered that contention and found that the pragmatic evidence of a sort to the contrary was not wanting. The court noted that the federal courts themselves have operated under the exclusionary rule of Weeks for almost half a century, yet it has not been suggested either that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has thereby been rendered ineffective or that the administration of criminal justice in federal courts has thereby been disrupted. Moreover, the experience of the states is impressive. The movement towards the rule of exclusion has been halting, but seemingly inexorable. The ignoble shortcut to conviction left open to the state tends to destroy the entire system of constitutional restraints on which the liberties of the people rest. Having once recognized that the right to privacy embodied in the Fourth Amendment is enforceable against the states, and that the right to be secure against rude invasions of privacy by state officers is therefore constitutional in origin, we can no longer permit that right to remain an empty promise. Because it is enforceable in the same manner and to like effect as other basic rights secured by the Due Process Clause, we can no longer permit it to be revocable at the whim of any police officer who, in the name of law enforcement itself, chooses to suspend its enjoyment. Our decision, founded on reason and truth, gives to the individual no more than that which the Constitution guarantees him, to the police officer no less than that to which honest law enforcement is entitled, and to the courts that judicial integrity so necessary in the true administration of justice. The judgment of the Supreme Court of Ohio is reversed, and the cause remanded for further proceedings not inconsistent with this opinion. Reversed and remanded.